The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Well, welcome to this week's edition of Capital Thinking. I'm not Kevin O'Neill, but I'm Mike Dino, a senior policy advisor from Patton Boggs' Denver office, and I'm guest hosting today's show in place of my colleague, Kevin O'Neill. I'm coming live from Denver today in Colorado and all around the country. It may be fall, but the ski slopes in Colorado are open just an hour west of our Mile High City, so it's a great fall day out here in the west, and we're going to bring the news and views of Washington to you today with a little western flavor. All our policy folks and attorneys on today's show come from the Denver office of Patton Boggs. It may be of interest to note before we get going today that outside of Washington, D.C., the Denver area has the largest population of federal employees. So what happens in Washington closely affects us here in the heart of the Rocky Mountains. Our first guest today is very familiar with Colorado politics. He was reared in the liberal hotbed of Boulder, Colorado, and came of age as a Republican state legislator representing the western suburbs of Denver. Matt Needler is a public policy analyst in the Denver Patton Boggs office, and he keeps his eyes and ears glued to the political ramblings around the state. Just a year ago, he and his GOP brethren were reeling from an election that definitively changed Colorado from a red state to a blue. Now today, Colorado Republicans seem to be smelling victory. Hey, Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What would you say has changed in the last year that gives Republicans in Colorado so much more hope as the 2010 elections near?
You know, it's interesting. I think this is certainly, as you noted, Colorado is had a lot of Democratic Party success here in the last few elections. It was really a precursor to what happened nationally. In 2004, the Democrats won the state legislature and a U.S. Senate seat. In 2006, of course, the Democratic Party won Congress. And then in 2006 in Colorado, the Democrats won the gubernatorial seat overwhelmingly. And in 2008, Democrats in Washington and around the country won the presidential seat. So it's been a precursor kind of a state over the last few election cycles. And so the question is now with a lot of changes certainly in Washington and with Democrats having been firmly in power here in Colorado beginning in 2004, but especially since 2006, how will voters react with their first real ability to reelect some of the people that came in with this Democratic wave? And I think what we're seeing is now that certainly, we have a president who's no longer, a Republican, an unpopular Republican president on the ballot or in the minds of voters. The Democrats are very much going to be running on their own platform and their own message without something to contrast as easily. And so Republicans feel that this is a chance for them to redefine themselves here and reestablish their ability to be known as the party of fiscal conservatism. And we've also got some bright younger candidates coming up here who have garnered a lot of national attention in the Republican Party. And his background, of course, as you mentioned, I've been in the legislature. I was a Republican legislator there. So coming at it from that perspective, you know, I think we see an ability within that party to at least give a sort of a different take in this next upcoming election.
Well, tell me about the Colorado voter rolls. I mean, it seems that things have really swayed toward the Democratic side, where you have a governor in both chambers of the legislature that are Democrat, as well as the delegation being five or seven Democrats out of the nine slots.
Yeah, I neglected to
mention that. What's the voter registration in Colorado?
You know, voter registration has definitely shifted to almost a toss-up. If the Democrats don't yet have an advantage, they may by next year. And you may know those numbers better than I. I believe that in 2008, you know, we had gone from, in 2004, about 100,000 vote registration advantage for Republicans to less than 30,000 in 2008. And I want to say, I'm not sure what those numbers are now. Again, you might have those, but credit to the Democratic Party for you know, doing a lot of operational things correctly here in Colorado, and innovatively since 2004. You know, with a lot of sort of taking the retail politics of registering like-minded voters, you know, doing a lot of on-the-ground grassroots efforts correctly. And that's really one of the reasons, I'm sure, as you can speak to, as the former CEO of the Democratic National Convention Host Committee, one of the reasons that Democrats looked to Colorado as an example of highlighting success, because they learned a lot from what Colorado Democrats did here.
Well, and I guess it's important to point out to our listeners that the registration is a third Republican, a third Democrat, and a third unaffiliated voters. What's your view on how unaffiliated voters are going to affect the elections in 2010 in Colorado?
Well, I think they're everything. I think, you know, although that's not to say that there's not a lot of crossover between, you know, Democrats voting for Republicans on occasion and Democrats and Republicans voting for Democrats. It's a very independent-minded state, like so many states these days. I think most of them are looking to see leaders who do a lot of bipartisan work and are willing to cross the aisle. We've got a tradition of certainly in the Senate seat, one of the big races next year, of course, the U.S. Senate seat that had been vacated by Senator Ken Salazar, and Michael Bennett was now a senator appointed by Governor Ritter to take that seat. That's always especially been a seat where, you know, they've looked to sort of a moderate or a maverick kind of a senator, and you know, Ben Nighthorse Campbell, having held that seat and actually switched parties in 1994, is a perfect example of that.
Well, we have a lot of folks that tune into this show to understand what's happening in Washington, and we have two really key seats. You mentioned the Senate seat. Why don't you talk a little bit about how that's shaping up in terms of that race on both sides of the aisle, and then we have also a seat on our Eastern Plains that's going to be very competitive.
Yes, absolutely. As you know, the beginning of this year, President Obama appointed Senator Ken Salazar to become the Interior Secretary, which left a vacancy that Governor Ritter appointed Denver Public Schools Superintendent Michael Bennett to fill. Senator Bennett hails from Denver. And he will be facing now in the primary another bright young, just as he is a younger senator and with an Ivy League pedigree, he will be facing another bright Democrat opponent who is the former Speaker of the Colorado House of Representatives, Andrew Romanoff. And he, too, has an Ivy League pedigree. So it's a fascinating primary because there's so many similarities between the two people vying for the Democratic Party nomination, and then we've got a multifaceted race on the Republican side that includes former Lieutenant Governor Jane Norton, not to be confused with former Interior Secretary Gail Norton, who Lieutenant Governor Norton has a lot of support here within certainly a lot of the infrastructure that helped Governor Bill Owens get elected in 1998 and again in 2002. And then you've got district attorney from the northern suburbs of Denver named Ken Buck, who has been in the race for quite some time now, several quarters already, and was probably the front runner until this recent development of Jane Norton entering the race. And then there are several other candidates, but those are really the top two. We've got one dropping out today, actually, on the Republican side, a city councilman from Aurora named Brian Frazier, who's going to announce that he'll be running for the 7th congressional seat against Congressman Ed Perlmutter.
Well, that is an interesting development. Our 7th congressional seat here in the metro area of Denver was designed to be a competitive seat, but when the Republicans won it, they held on to it for a while, and certainly now that the Democrats have it, Ed Perlmutter's been able to hold on to it. Do you see any changes happening there?
Well, I don't know. We'll see how Mr. Frazier does in terms of his fundraising capacity now that he's going to have a less of a contested primary. There is another announced candidate in there affiliated with the Tea Party movement. As you noted, Congressman Bob Beaupre had won that seat when it became Colorado's 7th seat through redistricting in 2002 by just 121 votes. So that race, since then, the Democrats have really, that's been one of the areas where they've really improved their voter registration numbers, and operationally they are, I would say, far advanced from the Republicans. But with a good candidate, there's certainly a chance for Republicans there. As you mentioned, there's a seat on the eastern slope.
It looked like that the Democratic incumbent, Betsy Markey, has done pretty well with fundraising so far, and I know the Republicans have been hopeful for that seat, so how do you feel where things are going with that?
It's both the U.S. Senate seat and that congressional seat are rated as top 10 races by the Washington Post and a number of other publications. I believe this is rated, this congressional seat we're discussing is the number 9th most competitive race as rated by the Washington Post. Congresswoman Markey is doing a lot of good things in terms of fundraising, but she's also certainly being cautious with her voting record. As you can imagine, a lot of the issues that are coming before Washington right now, really play. The dynamics are very interesting to learn to measure in these competitive districts. How will a congresswoman who's going to be in a difficult race next year, how will she vote on climate change legislation, healthcare legislation? She's facing three Republicans vying for the nomination.
We'll have to kind of.
Sure.
Those are out there. Appreciate you taking the time to be with us, and thanks for joining us today. We'll be back with our next segment on Capital Thinking in a few moments.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Finish.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back to Capital Thinking. This is Mike Dino today from Denver, Colorado, our Patton Boggs office here in the Mile High City, and I'm guest hosting for my colleague Kevin O'Neill today. Well, we're glad to be with you from out here in the West. Our Broncos are 5-0, and so folks tend to be a little preoccupied with that when we get to football season, but we certainly have time to learn a little bit more about what's happening in Washington. And our next guest is Patton Boggs' attorney, John Voorhees, from the Denver office. He splits his time, actually, between Washington and Colorado, so he has a great perspective on how our nation's capital connects with their Mile High City. John's practice focuses on corporate compliance, environmental and civil litigation, and also white-collar criminal defense. Relative to his discussion today, John also creates compliance systems that have been in the forefront of environmental management for many years. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mike.
Hey, with healthcare and the Nobel Peace Prize having dominated the headlines recently, a lot of other things tend to kind of get behind the scenes and aren't known by a lot of people. But today, I know you want to tell us about another important development that recently is connected to the president, and specifically the executive order he signed on October 5th. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I can. It's entitled The Federal Leadership in Environmental, Energy, and Economic Performance.
That's a lot there.
Yeah, there's
maybe
a lot there.
After the Nobel Peace Prize, you have a hard time remembering that one.
Well, the purpose of the executive order is to create a clean energy economy for the federal government as it operates in the United States. And this order that was signed on October 5th requires federal agencies to set targets for such things as greenhouse gas emissions, increasing energy efficiency, reducing the fleet petroleum consumption, conserving water, reducing waste, supporting sustainable communities. You get the picture. It's a broad order. And And in order to really understand the scope of something like this, you got to ask a question, well, who are we dealing with? And how many people are involved? And so let me just give you a couple of statistics here so you can see just how sweeping this order is. There are 1.8 million federal employees in the United States, 500,000 buildings, and 600,000 vehicles. And if you think those are really large numbers, you got to add just a couple of other components to this. The military, the postal service, and the biggest category by far, federal contractors and everyone else that is working with the government on government grants. That's who's covered by this order.
Do you think when there are RFPs, requests for proposals put out, and competitive bids, that they'll be required to begin to adhere to this new executive order?
Yes, they will. So businesses are definitely going to be interested in the order, and be filing their applications for federal funds and for contracts and whatever, following the principles. That grand total, according to the Washington Post now, is between 12 and 14 million people.
Jeez, that's a lot. Well, and I mentioned when I opened up here that Colorado has always been purported to have the second largest amount of federal employees and federal presence outside of Washington, D.C. So how would you see that affecting what happens here in Colorado with our federal footprint?
Well, I think that smart businesses are going to be very focused in on how they can provide services and products to the federal government. Using the principles that are set forth in the executive order. And so I think that any what I'd call small, medium, or large business that wants to do work with the federal government is going to be looking at this and saying, yeah, we can and we should establish some targets and some performance requirements to fulfill the requirements imposed by the executive order, and to align our environmental interests with the interests that President Obama has articulated in this executive order. And so specifically with respect to Colorado, what that means is that businesses in Colorado or anywhere else are going to be focused on how to achieve similar targets in their own practices, and then to showcase or demonstrate them to the federal government.
And is there a connection with what's happening on the international front to why this was particularly put in place on October 5th?
Well, you have to consider the context. You know, there's two big events coming up internationally. One was a surprise, and that was, of course, the Nobel Prize last week that occurred, you know, really contemporaneously with the execution of the order. And the second is the International Copenhagen meeting, which is in December of 2009. And so let me just start with saying a couple of comments about that. You know, that is the huge international meeting of all the countries to talk about the environment and energy. And obviously President Obama is going to want to have something to showcase at that meeting for the United States. Now, he doesn't have climate change or energy legislation yet, but an executive order like this, which establishes some very rigorous targets across the board, is going to have, a very positive impact for him with regard to discussing what the United States is doing internationally to these international leaders. And I think he's going to be asking some other leaders to step up to the plate with respect to what they're doing internally on environmental and energy issues. And so it specifies in the order that the administration wants to lead by example, and I think that's what he's doing here.
Well, and you mentioned the climate change legislation. The House passed their version of it earlier this year. There's a debate on whether the Senate version will make it anywhere this year. But an executive order doesn't have the power of legislation. the signature of obviously the president after the legislation is passed. How is an executive order enforced?
Well, it's interesting. The president can do a lot with the stroke of a pen with regard to the federal government. And this isn't the first one of these executive orders. In fact, President Clinton started this in April of 2000 with his initial what we'll call greening of the federal government order, which was in the last year of his presidency. Then President Bush also had an executive order with regard to establishing some principles of sustainability in 2007. And interestingly, President Obama issues this order in the first year of his administration. Now, what that means in terms of enforceability is that he's got at least another 3 years and maybe seven to monitor the requirements that are imposed here, and also to achieve the levels that are set forth in the executive order. It gives him a lot of time to have his senior environmental people analyze the requirements, and again, the way this is enforced is principally by the power of the presidency. He just signs the order and then delegates the responsibilities to the senior environmental officials in the administration.
You know, we have a lot of regional offices in particularly Denver, downtown Denver. The EPA built a new building recently and they actually built a very environmentally sustainable building with LEED certification. Give us an example of how that, being one of the top agencies obviously dealing with the environment, will handle this executive order.
Well, that's a great example of a building that has really a tremendous track record on improving the environment. It was a green building, and for those EPA people who are working in that building, they've done an awful lot already. The chief environmental officer in the administration now is Michelle Moore, and she comes from the the Green Building Council. And so what we're going to be expecting is that there will be other buildings built like the EPA building in Denver. The EPA building can be a model for sure. But there will be an increase in sustainability planning. And by that, the executive order requires, when you're siting federal facilities, to take into consideration sustainability requirements. And so there will be, a lot of interest in how the government is planning additional facilities, expanding facilities, and also eliminating certain non-productive, environmentally poor facilities along the way. So I guess that building in Denver is going to be a model to what we've done so far, and then we'll see a lot more examples in the next couple of years.
And John, give us some just brief information. Where can they find this executive order? They go to the White House website and track that down if people want to learn more about it?
Yes, it's right on the White House website. Again, it's October 5th, 2009, signed by the president. I don't have an actual executive order number right now.
Okay, we'll look for that on the website.
Leadership.
Thanks for joining us today, and we'll end it there, and we'll be back with more Capital Thinking in just a moment. Thank you very much.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth?
The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patent Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patent Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patent Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes
Nico.
Business transactions
Yes.
the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back to Capital Thinking. This is Mike Dino from Denver, Colorado, in our Patton Boggs here in the office in the Mile High City. I'm guest hosting today for Kevin O'Neill. We got a beautiful fall day here in Denver, Colorado. We've already had our first snow of the season, but we're back up in the 60s, going to be in the 70s today. And opposite of what people think, we don't get a lot of snow here. We always have great weather. And we were glad most of the snow stays up in the mountains. And one of the things that we benefit from is having almost 300 days of sunshine here in the Denver area, and that's something that has really pushed our new energy economy in a lot of ways is alternative energy. And today we're joined by my colleague here in Denver, James Muchmore, along with Colleen Rauscher, who is the Director and Vice President of Communications and Marketing for the Global Energy Options, which we'll refer to as GEO going forward today. James and Colleen, thanks for being on our program.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right. I hope you're here in Denver enjoying the great weather today.
Yes, it's fantastic.
Colleen, I'll start out with you. Tell us a little bit about GEO, and I noticed on your website you say that you and your firm are focused on complementing existing energy sources to make an impact today. Tell us what that means.
Absolutely. We are a privately held technology company in Denver, Colorado, and we're really committed to developing technologies that promote sustainable energy in all kinds of different ways. And right now, for us, that means promoting efficiency of technologies and fuel sources and infrastructure that already exist. We really believe in everybody who's in this race with solar, wind, biofuels. But so many of these technologies require an entire infrastructure shift, and that's going to take a lot of money and a lot of time. And we really feel the urgency to start trying to make an impact for our environment now, and so that's what we're trying to do with our technologies.
And why Colorado? I mean, why can't you be somewhere else trying to make this work?
The honest answer to that question is we all want to live in Colorado. So we set up shop here. And we're happy to be here. It's the best environment for a startup in the energy industry. Everybody we come in contact with, from people at NREL to politicians to venture capitalist lawyers, they're just fantastic people. Everybody's on Colorado time. A lot of things are done with a handshake, and we couldn't be more proud to be in this environment, and hopefully Colorado can incubate us and help us succeed.
And certainly the federal government has begun to be a wonderful partner in this particular industry. You mentioned NREL, the National Renewable Energy Labs, which as I look out my window, I can see their buildings not too far away. Tell us about NREL. They have a great federal presence here. They're a wonderful partner when it comes to the new energy economy. Tell us your experience with them.
They've been fantastic supporters. As you know, they do a lot of research in hydrogen on their own. One of the things they're working to formulate is to help entrepreneurs specifically to launch their business. And this is such a new industry that they're feeling their way along as they go, just like everybody else is. I really liken it to the dot-com, you know, boom. We don't know how these energies are going to be adopted ultimately, and so there's a lot of things to figure out along the way. Thus far, we've been able to really go it alone and remain a private company and not use any of the stimulus funds. And the main reason for that is we're really focused on a customer order. And so from that perspective, we haven't used them directly, but they've been incredible advisors and so open and met with us multiple times.
That's great. James, tell us a little bit about, with Pat and Boggs being in the middle of the Denver area and Colorado, and our focus on certainly trying to be a part of this new energy economy. Tell me how we focus on being a partner with companies like Geo.
Sure. Mike, we're fortunate here in the Pat and Boggs Denver office because we do support a large number of new energy clients, and specifically with respect to Geo, we've been fortunate in the sense that we've been able to advise them as they've started up more tangible operations with their company, and we've also been able to support them and introduce them to either folks at NREL or whether it be state or federal representatives and agencies so that they can tap those federal and state sources that are supportive to the development of their technology and to the growth of their business. So like with Geo and their hydrogen products, as well as with other wind and solar companies, fortunately, because of our national presence as well as our strong presence and reputation in the Denver area, we're able to work closely with many of these new clients, and whether it be introducing them to public sources or working with them and private sources of capital or private sources of just general support, technology support, I think we're really able to serve as an incubator and a supporter of many of these companies, specifically with respect to Geo as well.
What would you say are a couple of challenges that a company like Colleen's faces when you're introduced to them and you get a chance to visit with them?
Well, unfortunately, over the last couple of years, with the downturn in the economy, some of the biggest challenges the new energy companies has had, obviously, has been private capital. Fortunately, however, with the Stimulus Act that was passed in this past year, as well as the 2005 Energy Policy Act, there are sources of capital that are a little bit more available to new energy clients in Denver and really throughout the country. That being said, as things have turned around over the last 4 to 5 months, we've really seen a lot of private capital start to take a second look at some of the new energy clients that we're working with and start to actually go through and make some investments, whether it be short-term or long-term, because I think the general public as well as the private capital public believe that the new energy economy is here to stay.
Colleen, I got to imagine that as a smaller company with the newer technologies, you mentioned that you have a private customer that you're working with. I mean, what have you found to be the challenges of taking your product and getting into the marketplace and getting a foothold in building upon it?
You know, I think really the biggest issue that so many of these technologies face that we were really focused on was, again, working with existing infrastructure. I think that you can have the best technology in the world, but if the economics aren't there for your customer, you're never gonna see implementation. And so for us, the biggest challenge was narrowing our focus to an industry that would be a great partner and saw the greatest benefit. For us, the opportunity presented itself with the rail industry. It's been an enormous supporter for us. And the main reason is our hydrogen retrofit technology delivers enormous fuel savings and emissions reductions. And in an industry like rail, the economics are there. A new locomotive is about $2 million. The largest rail operator uses about 95,000 barrels of diesel fuel a day. So when they heard about a technology that could reduce their fuel consumption and help them meet emission standards without having to purchase new locomotives. They're obviously really enthusiastic about adopting this new technology. So for us, that obstacle was just narrowing our focus to an industry that was going to make sense and making sure that the economics were there with our technology, that a customer could implement it and see the return on investment quickly. And, you know, we believe that's the greatest way to make an impact on the environment.
So did you have a customer before you had the technology, or the technology before the customer?
Well, we've had the technology for about 2 years. We've really been perfecting it. We see that as another issue that a lot of technology companies face. They're so excited to get to market that they do it prematurely, and the importance of perfecting the reliability and execution of the technology is so important. So we were working on that when we got introduced to rail as a possible option, and so it's been a perfect development to just go straight to market with them.
And in terms of your peers in the new energy economy, I mean, is there a growing consortium of businesses that are banding together to create sort of a power base to influence legislation, not only here in Colorado, but in Washington? I mean, do you see a lot of you see in the traditional fossil fuel energy and environment, there's always a lot of a lot of press about their lobbying and their political throw weight. How do you see the new energy economy and its businesses coming together to get a good voice?
Right now, I think the largest groups that have done that have been solar and wind. I think that's because they make sense to people. It's logical how those energies work, how the technologies work. For technologies like we have with a hydrogen retrofit and a lot of really unusual technologies, I think the biggest issue we face in working with policymakers is that inherent in an emerging technology is that it's never been done before. So legislators are constantly trying to figure out, how do you make policy for the exception? Because these are all exceptions. They're all different. They're all unique. And what kind of legislation is going to support them to grow their business? So from that perspective, it seems to me that we're sort of, building the airplane as we fly. But the best thing we can do in terms of our participation is to stay active in the dialogue and make sure that we're inputting our expertise where we can. And to be honest, I think the greatest impact we can make is to be successful in the marketplace and then use customers who are seeing the benefits of a sustainable technology and really leverage that to make an impact, because I think a few successes will really help us navigate this road that's going to be quite difficult both for policymakers and for technology producers in the marketplace.
So, and what GEO is producing with this hydrogen retrofit? Is your product already in play with the railroad and implemented, or are you still working on that?
We're going to keep a lot of that confidential at this point. We are already in play in a number of different areas, and the biggest test right now is just making sure that our customers can see the savings across the board. It works with any fossil fuel on any diesel engine, so the options are limitless, and we're working through what's the best way for customers to implement that fleet-wide many times, whether that's a stationary power generator or a moving locomotive.
Well, we really appreciate you and James joining us today, and it was great to learn about GEO, and hope you have a lot of success in the future. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. We'll be back with Capital Thinking soon. Thank you.
The following is a paid advertisement.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street. to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back to Capital Thinking. This is Mike Dino today from the Denver Patton Boggs office. I'm guest hosting for my colleague Kevin O'Neill. And we got a great day here in Denver, Colorado. Denver's economy has fared a little better than the national economy. Still a lot of challenges, certainly for our municipalities in this area, but by and large, people have felt that there have been past economic downturns that have really hurt the city much more. And that turns us today to talking on our last segment today, one of our newest attorneys in Denver's Patton Boggs office, Jeff Cohen. Jeff has served as lead counsel for the planning and execution of numerous business restructuring cases, including the restructuring of troubled municipal bond issues, and lead exchanger counsel for several multi-million-dollar bankruptcies. Jeff, welcome to the show today.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
I'm glad that you joined our office, and I'm sure you're well familiar with our Patton Boggs program now, and I'm glad you could join us on the radio today. Before we really get into some of the details of what you focus on with your practice, let me ask you, you know, what's your gut feel on when we're really going to see some very positive, sustained momentum with our economy? Yesterday, obviously, was very positive for the market. Do you think that we're on the upward trend for a while now?
Well, I hate to be a wet blanket on this one, but I really don't. I think some of the keys that people need to focus on is the long-term bond market and the value of the dollar internationally. Because I think that the value of the dollar now is going down to all-time lows, and it's starting to affect long-term yields in the U.S. bond market, which, of course, will feed back into 30-year mortgages and real estate values. But, of course, for the almost 30 years of my career, I've always played the bearish side of things. So for me, the glass is always half empty.
Yeah, so we got a little more way to go, but at least I guess, as I mentioned here in Denver, things seem to be a little more stable than some of the other parts of the country you've been dealing with. Tell us about the municipal market. What is that, and what kind of securities are involved in that market?
Well, it's interesting. People I don't think, have as detailed or granular a view of the market as it really is, because it's split up into essentially two types. You've got revenue bonds that are issued to finance a specific project, and they're paid out or paid off from the revenues of a specific project. Then you have something called general obligation bonds, which are issued by a municipality. And the general revenues of that municipality then are subject to that debt. Overlaid onto those two general types, you've got something called rated issues, which are given a credit rating by a Standard & Poor's or Moody's or Fitch. And they're usually issued by the larger, more sophisticated, or more creditworthy customers. And then you have the unrated market, which actually is 60% of the entire municipal market, which people are going to be surprised to hear is in the many trillions of dollars. And it really rivals the United States government bond market. So you've got 60% of the market as unrated, and they're issued by things called special districts or metropolitan districts, water districts, things of that nature. And the credit worthiness of many of these districts is oftentimes suspect, and they're oftentimes relatively transparent vehicles for real estate finance and for real estate developers to access the municipal capital markets, which is cheaper for a developer to borrow money in the municipal capital markets than it is for him to borrow it from a bank or from the capital markets, private capital markets. And that's because the interest that a holder of a municipal bond gets is tax exempt and doesn't have to be put on the tax return, or is not taxed by the federal government. So then the money becomes cheaper for the developer to borrow if he has access to the municipal capital markets through these unrated issues that are issued by special taxing districts. I know that sounds very complicated, but the municipal markets are very complicated, and for many, many years, at least up until the first quarter of 2009, they were very, very sleepy, and people just would cut the coupons or get the interest payments on a regular basis. And
so in 2009, when we had the credit crisis, I mean, that changed everything in the municipal markets, I imagine.
Oh, indeed. The big catalyst was the Nuveen bond funds. They had been playing around with some sophisticated derivative securities and were forced to literally dump their portfolios on the market, the portfolios of municipal bonds of all sizes and stripes in the first quarter, which depressed municipal bond prices extraordinarily low. And the municipal bond indexes had hit by a fairly well hit historical lows, which itself opened up opportunities in the market. But those were technical factors due to the credit crisis generally and a sort of a financially driven depression in municipal securities prices.
Well, and we saw with, the federal government, they bailed out banks. They seemed to help out Wall Street insurance companies. How did they weigh in on this municipal market, and or did they?
Well, they specifically didn't. In fact, Barney Frank in the House Financial Services Committee held hearings in May of this year regarding a couple of bills that were coming up for passage to change various aspects of the municipal market. And there was testimony before his committee in late May and early June basically saying that congressmen would be calling up Geithner and or Bernanke and asking for some TARP money to help municipalities and help the municipal bond market, and they didn't even get their calls returned. It's pretty awful.
Yeah, well, and speaking of awful, I understand that you were involved with Jefferson County, Alabama, which includes the city of Birmingham, Alabama, in one of the largest municipal defaults in U.S. history. How were you involved in that, and what happened there?
Well, it's still going on as we speak, but I got involved as really an outside expert and consultant to the bond buyer, which is the largest trade organization for municipal securities. They've been around about 180 years, 170 years. And I've been working with them since the early 90s on Bridgeport, Connecticut bankruptcy, the Orange County, California bankruptcy. And so they called me a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago, because Birmingham had entered into a consent decree with the EPA back in the late 90s to build a new water treatment facility and new sewer facility, since they were polluting the river that went through the city of Birmingham. And they built the sewer system in the mid-2000s, and it was they had issued about $3.7 billion in revenue bonds in three different tranches, they're called, or three different types of issues. Then in the first quarter of 08, because one of those, about $900 million or $1 billion, started to go into default as a result, again, of some derivative.
So, Jeff, real quickly, are they going to get out of it, you think?
It's real difficult. You know, they had to lay off workers 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
We'll come back to you at some future time and find out what happened. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mike.
Appreciate it. And we appreciate everybody joining us today on Capital Thinking from Denver, Colorado. Have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.